Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's so hot in Louisiana right now, I think you could fry the proverbial egg on the sidewalk. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we're going to do our very best to cool you down and cool you off. First, we'll start with a little drink and tour the Old New Orleans Rum Distillery, where since 1995, artist James Michelopoulos has been using Louisiana sugarcane to handcraft small batches of rum in a 150-year-old cotton warehouse. Then, we'll take that bottle of rum out into the backyard and learn how to do low and slow barbecue with expert Colleen Rush. Finally, Beach Bum Barry's here to help us host the ultimate tiki party. Get out those Hawaiian shirts and grass skirts as we party Polynesian style on this week's Louisiana Eats. The Old New Orleans Rum Distillery opened its doors in 1995, and in those 20 years has distinguished itself as one of the finest craft rum producers in the world. Since their rum distillery is almost in my backyard, I couldn't resist arranging a visit to tour the operation and have a little tasting of this Louisiana elixir. The Old New Orleans Rum Distillery is housed in a 150-year-old cotton warehouse. Upon arrival, we were greeted by CEO Katie Darling.
Hello and welcome. My name is Katie Darling.
And the founder of Old New Orleans Rum, James Michelopoulos.
Hi, I'm James Michelopoulos.
They led me into the tasting room, which was tasteful in more ways than one. James isn't just the founder of Old New Orleans Rum. He's also a celebrated artist.
I've been in a lot of tasting rooms in this lifetime all over the world, and I have to say, this tasting room's artwork trumps all others. It's really spectacular. And James, I have to ask you, how in the world did someone who was already a celebrated painter, visual artist, how in the world did you end up in the rum business?
Long story short, I was fascinated by wines for quite a while and thought about making a wine and realized that growing grapes in Louisiana was not a very likely development, and considered the fact that we were surrounded by sugarcane. I also had a lot of experience during my college years with rum, so I recalled those many evenings and put it together as an opportunity for something to create.
And what year did all of this begin?
Well, we started about 1990, roughly, and maybe even a little bit earlier than that. But we did experiments for a number of years over in a little apartment in the Bywater. And then gradually, slowly but surely, we got larger and larger, and it became a likely prospect for an enterprise.
You really are a bit of a Renaissance man, because not only are you an amazing artist, you're an inventor?
Well, I love invention. I find the challenges of life always interesting. In any case, here we are, and we are making rum and confronted by the need for machinery, equipment, progress, etc. So, yeah, I engage in that opportunity with my compatriots, and we've created a couple of stills here that we think are state of the art. We know they're state of the art, and we love the product that we're getting off of it. We feel that our white rum, for example, is among the very best in the world right now, and that's built on a still that was invented right here at Celebration Distillation and built by us. So, yeah, we're proud of that.
From there, we entered onto the main floor of the distillery, where the sweet smell of molasses was immediately noticeable. Well-worn wooden barrels, emblazoned with red and black fleur-de-lis, lined one wall from floor to ceiling, right next to massive metal tanks.
So when you first enter the warehouse, we have two large molasses tanks. So this holds Louisiana molasses from Thibodaux. So we get this molasses from LeFou Sugar Mill. A gentleman named Greg Nolan is our contact there. And we really feel this connection with the sugar mill and Louisiana and the sugarcane community. So Greg Nolan was King Sucrose at this year's Sugarcane Festival. And we just really like to support Louisiana sugarcane. And to my surprise and many others, not all local rum is made from local sugarcane. So we take a lot of pride in getting it from LeFou Sugar Mill.
And the scent is just intoxicating. I mean, before it even becomes rum, the scent of the molasses is delicious.
We think that the flavor of our rum really starts from the quality ingredients from the beginning. So the delicious molasses that we source shines through to the end.
Absolutely. We move deeper into the warehouse and onto the production floor, where the staff was busy at work among the fermentation tanks.
So we're right here in the middle of the production floor that hosts our three fermentation tanks and our two large pot stills. So what you're hearing is an air pump that is pumping water into a fermentation tank. So once we have our polished distillate, we bottle it right here in-house, and I'll take you to our bottling shop in a little bit. But we also take that crystal rum and we put it into these beautiful barrels that you see. So we have stacks and stacks of barrels right here on the production floor, along the first wall, upstairs. And we have a variety of barrels. We have some whiskey barrels from a few different whiskey producers. We also have a few select sherry barrels.
What do the different barrels do, and what influence does the barrel itself have on the rum?
The age of the barrels, the use of the barrels prior to that, in addition to the quality of the rum that goes into it, turns into about five or six different variables, which the blender skillfully manages to finesse the final product. And that's where the art comes in. It's a wonderful part of the process and amazingly detailed and complicated in a sense. But it's also a lot like good cooking. Going over and over till you get it just right is the exacting requirement of a experienced distiller. And that's what we try to do for you.
James doesn't just try, he succeeds. His explanation of the use of barrels in the distillation process made me think of one thing: flavor.
So now we're going over to our blending room.
So I insisted that they show me where they make their delicious spiced rum, as well as my personal favorite, ginger roux.
So on this wall, there is a variety of spices which go directly into our Cajun spice blend. So we will take the barrels you see in front of you, we will put in an infusion bag with our recipe of spices, and it will sit for 30 days, and it will be stirred and tasted and monitored over those 30 days.
So how did ginger roux come about? Because to my thinking, I think that's a completely unique product. I don't think there's anything else like it on the market.
Yes, I suspect that we are alone out there. And how did it come about? It's really a very organic development. You know, in the process of working in a distillery, you're always in the middle of tasting and trying it out in different ways. And one part of that job is to try it out with things that people mix their products with. So at one point, many years ago, I'm thinking maybe 15 years ago or so, I made myself a drink with ginger ale and our newest rum, and I just loved the way that it came out. And in sharing that experience with one of my distillers, he said, "Well, you know, I'm an expert at making ginger ale." And I said, "Really? Well, show me." And so he made a batch of ginger ale. We made it right here, and he did a wonderful job. We put it together, and it was terrific. And I thought, This has got to be a great drink out there. So that's the origin of it right there. We started at that point 15 or so years ago, first time.
I've had a lot of ginger roux since it became available, I admit. But for people who have never tasted ginger roux before, would you sort of give us the flavor profile?
Sure. It's a very straightforward thing. We have a wonderful crystal rum in there, for starters. And it's a drink that has a 10% alcohol count. So somewhere between beer and wine, very, very quaffable. And that's really the essence of it right there. So we have fresh ginger and rum and some spices and a sweet Louisiana-based concoction that some people think is the elixir for the 21st century.
That's great.
Okay, where do we go next?
From there, we moved into the final phase of the production process, the bottling room. That's right. Everything from the distillation to putting the cap on the bottle happens right there at the distillery with just two bottling machines.
One is specifically for ginger root and the other is for our line of rums. Over here is a pressurized bottle filler, so we take every bottle by hand and press it into the machine, and it has a control that will fill it at exactly a liter or 750 milliliters. And then we take every cap and twist it on by hand. So a lot is done by hand.
It's just a really good example of how engaged our people are in this process. We're in there with the bottles, with the machinery, really working it. This is not an anonymous factory without humans in it. This is very old school on that level. We're engaged in every step of this process.
How many people work here?
Between full-time and part-time, we have 20 employees.
Now, we're only in about 14 states and four different countries internationally. And at this point, we're very comfortable with that. We really feel that we want to master each step of the way as we enlarge our business, that we don't at any point in time want to compromise our quality. And we're just really committed to doing the best that we can.
You've walked us through every step of the making of the rum, the bottling of the rum. Do you think we could have a taste?
Yes, of course. Let's head to the tasting room.
And just like that, we were back where we started. Except now, samples of the three rums were laid out, waiting to be tasted. All right, James. So the tastes are all lined up. Walk me through what we're going to taste and what I should be looking for. Where do we start? I imagine with the crystal.
Yeah, the crystal would be the right place to start. And so this is a pure white rum that is uninfluenced by wood. And it is, so the primary qualities of this rum come from the molasses, that Louisiana molasses that we use. So you can taste a good clarity and a very lovely, a natural flavor particular to our rum made from Louisiana sugarcane. And I think it is absolutely one of the best clear rums made in the world. Please give it a try.
Mm-mm. Delicious. Okay, so where do we go next?
Well, let's take a walk down Wood Alley and go into our number three. So this rum, while it's called number three, contains a blend of rums that are aged up to 6 years old. And so you're going to notice a lot of different characteristics. Let's give it a try.
One of the things that strikes me immediately is the nose to this one is different, because with the white rum, I'm catching sort of those deep, dark scents of the molasses. With this, somehow, it's almost like the antithesis of what you'd anticipate, because the first note I think I catch is vanilla.
Yeah.
Where do we go next?
Spiced rum.
Is that what this is?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that spiced rum. That is just wonderful. What do you believe sets your spiced rum apart from the others?
I know that what sets our spiced rum apart from the others is the fact that we use real spices. We haven't sacrificed any of that to this point, and we're not gonna.
I know all of this is proprietary and, you know, part of your great company secret, but how many spices could you tell us go into your spiced rum?
Actually, I could, but I'm not going to.
Okay.
So, yes, it is a proprietary formula, and there are a number of different spices in there. And as Katie said, they're very carefully calibrated to achieve the final result. Now, we don't want to give away our recipe, but somebody who loves to cook, somebody that loves to make a great drink, spends time trying out different levels, different qualities of spices. This is exactly how we got there, too, by a process of trial and error. So that's who we are. We're a commitment, first of all, to the naturalness of the product, that we use a process that doesn't in any way impair that, and that we're, you know, working to try to develop that and bring that into the industrial world too. Like, we're not leaving it behind just because we're growing, just because people love this product and because we win awards with it. It doesn't mean that we're going to let it grow out of its natural orientation. We're committed to that. We're going to stay right there.
I'll raise a glass to that. Cheers. James Michalopoulos and Katie Darling of Old New Orleans Rum Distillery. When we come back from a short break, we'll head out into the backyard for low and slow barbecue lessons with pit master Colleen Rush. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. With her flame red hair and a glass of bourbon in her hand, pitmaster and food writer Colleen Rush is setting the world of backyard barbecue on fire. Along with co-author Gary Viviot, the two created a comprehensive guide to barbecue technique in their latest book, Low and Slow 2, The Art of Barbecue, Smoke Roasting, and Basic Curing. Delighted to be talking with a female pitmaster for the very first time, I asked Colleen to tell us about how she first got started with low and slow barbecue.
I was living in Chicago for a couple of years, and I was hanging out with a food nerd community in Chicago, and I met a guy, Gary Viviot, who had developed this really basic program for teaching people backyard barbecue. And I mean, I grew up in Louisiana. I'm no stranger to the barbecue tradition. I grew up, my mom was, you know, the pig queen. She was the queen of the cochon de lait in 1959. So he had really developed this program for teaching people, and he knew that I was a writer, so we connected and we hit it off, and I helped him sort of expand this program that was specific to one cooker and expanded it to four. You know, for all the bravado and swagger that is in barbecue, that it's, you know, big, meaty, fire, caveman kind of cooking, I think that at the end of the day, it's really just about what's on the plate and your skills. And there are wonderful female pitmasters across the country, and one in particular has been doing it for years at Snow's Barbecue in Texas, in Lexington, Texas. Miss Tootsie Tominetz, I think she's 70-something years old and just a cute as a button and doing it the old school way. So it's rare, but again, it's fun. I don't mind being a woman in barbecue, but I think there are definitely people who have devoted their lives to it in a way that I haven't quite yet, but Tootsie's been doing it for a lot longer.
Well, when beautiful redheaded Colleen Rush shows up at the pit, do you ever feel any positioning coming from the guys? What's the reaction when suddenly you're part of the barbecue
There's
crew?
Definitely a little bit of, I think it is unusual. And yeah, I do stand out. I'm not small. I have bright red hair. So yeah, I think there is a little bit of hesitation. There is sort of that initial, like, what's a girl doing here? And how much can she possibly know? But again, I can talk the talk. I can walk the walk. I can throw down my swagger and bravado just as well as anybody else can. So I think if you stick around and show what you're made of, you can do it. You know, my team, Piggy Stardust, won Hogs for the Cause Best Ribs a couple of years ago when I was on the team. So, you know, we showed them girls can do it.
When it comes to making low and slow barbecue, what are the various choices you have for cooking it on?
Well, it's basically anything with charcoal and wood. There's a whole camp of people who don't believe in using gas grills, and I'm sort of part of that camp. If you're making true low and slow barbecue, it's got to be a charcoal cooker. The four that we outline in the book are the most popular ones, the ones that you see in every hardware store across the country, the Big Green Egg, the Weber Smoky Mountain, the offset cooker, and the kettle style grill. So it's really specific to those four cookers. But the recipes and the cooks sort of can be adapted to other cookers. As long as there's charcoal and wood, we can make some barbecue.
So the first-time barbecuer, the one who's just learning this low and slow method, what are the major pitfalls that they should be looking out for?
Well, I think the first one would be to not use lighter fluid. We outline that pretty clearly in the book, and that can make your meat taste like chemicals. So you want to start with a chimney starter and start a clean fire. That's one of the basic tenets, is building a clean fire. And then the next one, I would caution people against using a lot of wood. I think the tendency is when you're just starting out to smoke the meat, you use a lot of wood, and it creates this really heavy, almost like creosote-y flavor. It's this metallic, heavy smoke flavor. So I would say use less wood than you think is necessary, and then build from there. I mean, the whole fun of barbecue is learning and building your instincts and going slow. It's low and slow, so take it easy. You're not going to knock it out of the park the first time. Don't oversmoke your meat. Keep an eye on your fire. Keep it clean and keep an eye on the temperature, and that's pretty much it. It's that easy.
Marinades, rubs, sauces. What is your opinion on that topic?
You know, I think a good brine on poultry is important. I think when you're cooking as long as a low and slow cook is, you run the risk of drying out the meat. So I think a brine is kind of important in a marinade. You definitely add flavor to it. But I think when you're smoking, you run the risk of using too many things. You know, people get this idea, again, that sauce and rub, it's all about some magical sauce or secret rub. But really, it's about putting a little bit of smoke flavor on the meat. And, you know, the other flavors are really more of an accent than an ingredient.
In your latest book, there's some things that I just never thought of before. Tell me about goose breast pastrami. Who thought that up, and what is that?
Well, that is definitely a Gary recipe. That's one of his signatures, and it is one of our baby steps to learning how to cure. That's one of the ways that you learn how, if you want to start making bacon or charcuterie or these other sort of heavier duty things. Again, poultry is a good one to start with because it's inexpensive and it is delicious. It is, you know, a few days of curing and a little technique here and there, and then putting a light smoke on it, and it is the charcuterie. It's baby step to charcuterie.
Well, I'd like some of that goose breast pastrami. That sounds really, really delicious. And for you, what are the sides that you think do the best at a backyard barbecue? Because I know that in Low and Slow 2, y'all really kind of hit the sides a little bit.
We did. And you'll see a lot of them are things like corn and tomatoes. Those are the base of all of the sides. And I really do think those two things make a great side, especially if you're able to throw them on the smoker and pick up a little bit of that smoke flavor as well. The makchu that's in the book is one of my favorite recipes. I love that one. Smoked corn, elotes with the crumbled cheese on it is fantastic as well. But the sides, again, you know, if you're spending 12 hours on a brisket, you want to keep it light, you want to keep it simple, you want to keep it easy because you've got other things to worry about. So a lot of the recipes really focus on that principle, being light and easy and something that jives with barbecue.
Well, I know you have done exhaustive research about this. So now I would like you to tell me, if we were to go to Colleen Rush's house for her ultimate barbecue party, What would be there? How would that party roll out?
That is an excellent question. It would probably start with a couple of the sides from the book. The smoked corn makchu is an excellent one. Really getting into the smoked fish. I mean, after recipe testing for a year and a half of pork and beef, I've really started leaning a lot more towards the seafood, especially here in New Orleans. It's so easy to get great seafood. So I would start with a smoked shrimp appetizer and do sort of a classic seafood or shrimp cocktail appetizer, but with smoked shrimp. And maybe throw a little bit of smoke on that horseradish, get some fresh horseradish for that sauce. And then the breakout of the book, I think, is everybody knows brisket, but I think one of the new favorites in book two is definitely the Pitmaster Porchetta. It's a pork tenderloin rolled inside of a pork belly, and it's smoked for a little while, and then it's crisped for a little while, so you have this delicious, crispy, fatty, porky, awesome torpedo.
And what are we washing it down with?
Oh, wow. A good bourbon, or a nice light white wine, a nice crisp light white wine.
Well, I hope you invite me to that party when you throw it. Please give me a ring. It
Absolutely.
Sounds like fun.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Colleen.
Thanks, Poppy.
Colleen Rush, author of the Barbecue Bibles, Low and Slow 1 and 2. Recently, I was asked to do a cooking spot on a morning show. The producers wanted something traditionally Creole, but cold, since we're smack in the midst of the dog days of summer. Honestly, there aren't that many Creole classics that are served cold. Remoulade, ravigote, daube glacé? None of those things seem to fit the bill. And then I thought about what might be the most classic Creole dish of all. Red beans and rice. Now, I know cold red beans and rice may not sound very appealing, but rice salad isn't too far out of an idea. I came up with a red beans and rice salad that's vegan, vegetarian, and works perfectly on meatless Mondays when you're craving red beans and rice. Start with 2 cups of cooked rice. You've probably got some leftover hanging around in your fridge. I used Kurt Uncle's Cajun grain, a Louisiana rice that's incredibly nutritious and delicious, too. Thinly slice a rib of celery and a couple of green onions. Dice a little yellow bell pepper and one of those ripe Creole tomatoes that are so plentiful right now. Mix those ingredients well, and then, in a separate bowl, make a Creole mustard vinaigrette by whisking together some Zatarain's Creole mustard, cane vinegar, and olive oil. Pour the dressing over the rice salad, toss it all together, and then sprinkle on some fresh chopped parsley, and season your salad to taste with salt and Louisiana hot sauce. It's vegan, vegetarian, and best of all, it's cold! You can make this salad a day in advance, too. The flavors will just marry and deepen while it chills in the fridge. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org or at itsneworleans.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and my red beans and rice salad is real Louisiana Eats. Journalist, public radio contributor, and author of Louisiana Rambles, Ian McNulty is always hunting down a new, obscure, but delicious spot for rambling. Ian, where are we rambling to today?
Well, Poppy, today we're taking a little trip to Lafayette to check out a place I just discovered recently, but has quickly grown near and dear to my heart and, more importantly, to my belly.
Oh, yes, and what is that?
Okay, this place is called Johnson's Boucanière. Now, boucanière, some people out there already know, I'm sure, is the Acadian word for smokehouse. And that is exactly what it is. This is basically Johnson's Smokehouse. And it's a old traditional butcher shop smokehouse in Lafayette, working with these Cajun traditions. But it has a really interesting backstory to it. It's a fairly new place. It opened in 2008. But like a lot of interesting good things in Louisiana, its roots really go back a bit.
Really? How far?
So back to 1937, when a place called Johnson's Grocery opened up in Eunice, a great town for Cajun music, Cajun culture.
And Cajun meat.
And Cajun meat, absolutely. Well, Johnson's Grocery was a little dry goods place when it first opened, but it evolved over the generations into like one of the real go-to places in the Cajun prairie for boudin, of course, our favorite rice and pork sausage there in the links. You know, the Cajun breakfast, the Cajun lunch, the Cajun dinner, the Cajun snack, the Cajun everything, boudin. Well, sadly, to a lot of people, Johnson's Grocery closed in 2005 after, you know, a really long run of decades and decades and decades. But a few years later, another generation of the family just got the itch to get back into the business and really to reignite these old family recipes that were so popular there for so long. And they opened Johnson's Boucanière. Now, this is in Lafayette. It's not in Eunice. But if you were familiar with Johnson's Grocery's Boudin and you taste what they're doing now at Johnson's Boucanière, same thing. It's same recipe, that same just really good snap to the link and just meaty links of boudin. They're peppery, but really more about savory seasoning than like spicy, spicy hot boudin. Really, to me, like one of the best links of boudin out there.
And what else do you get there besides boudin?
Well, this is a great place. I mean, the boucanière part, of course, the smokehouse, can mean a lot of different things in Cajun country. Here, in addition to boudin, it's really about barbecue, you know.
Barbecue?
Yeah, it really functions as a Cajun barbecue restaurant. So you got a lot of smoked sausage there, of course, tasso, but also ribs and pork roasts and brisket, all just, you know, done with a little more spice and zing. Now, when you find this place, and I should say it's just on the edge of downtown Lafayette, just outside of the business district there, and not too far from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, it looks from the outside like a little grocery store, you know, and it's kind of packed inside with all sorts of clutter and stuff and little signs to read everywhere. And you can go in and get a pound of this or a pound of that. You can also eat in, and they have all kinds of sandwiches and plate lunches. And everyone eats kind of outside on this kind of wraparound patio deck that really kind of looks like more modern and contemporary. So it's sort of this interesting mashup of the old and the new at this place. And they're also, in addition to their food, they're really about music. They're really into promoting local music. You'll see CDs from local Cajun and Zydeco artists all over the walls, and that Lafayette roots music that's really coming back so strong. And you'll probably see a few musicians that you might recognize from the local festival circuit chowing down there as well.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So what are they eating, you know, besides the boudin? They have things like the Parrain Special, which is basically their idea of a Cajun grilled cheese with a fried boudin ball smashed, covered in barbecue sauce, American cheese, all on an Evangeline-made bun. Evangeline-made being the kind of the big, like almost the big nostalgic kind of bread brand out there. And just really interesting sort of combinations of like smoked pulled chicken covered with smoked garlic pork sausage. I mean, just all these things all together on buns and on plates. The taste is really fabulous. Now, I mentioned it's mostly a lunch place, mostly about lunch or to pick up a feed to bring home, or in the case of our travelers out there, for the cooler, for something to bring back home to wherever you're traveling to. And they do close early on most nights, 6 o'clock, but stay open a little bit later on the weekends if you're going to make a fun weekend of it out there in Lafayette.
Can you buy like a whole chicken? Or?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. When you go in, you'll see some people who are just there for lunch and others who are obviously stocking up for a big feed at home. So really what we have here, Johnson's Boucanière, it's a modern reengineering of a really old traditional Cajun country smokehouse with a long tradition to it. You see this in a lot of places, you know, and a lot all over the country, really. It's a trend. But when it happens in South Louisiana, it's going to be really fun and delicious.
Well, you have made me some hungry. Let's go.
Okay. I'm right behind you.
Okay. You ready to ramble?
Yeah, let's ramble on.
Thank you, Ian. Louisiana Eats ramblin' reporter, Ian McNulty. What is the difference between hamburger, ground round, ground chuck, and ground sirloin? Stay tuned, and we'll demystify ground beef when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the difference between hamburger, ground round, ground chuck, and ground sirloin? To begin, if the meat is labeled hamburger, leave it alone. anything can go into hamburger meat, so let's not even go there. If you want to grill a great burger, then go for the ground chuck. Chuck comes from the shoulder and neck and has enough fat to add flavor and the juiciness you're looking for in a burger. If you're willing to sacrifice flavor for calorie count, then buy the 80% lean ground beef. There's a 102 calorie difference between a 4-ounce ground chuck burger versus a 4-ounce burger of 80% lean. Ground round comes from the rump, which tends to be tougher, but has lots of beefy flavor and is good for meat sauces that simmer a bit. A lot of people nowadays prefer ground sirloin. It's tender and flavorful, but only contains 8 to 10% fat. So you better cook that sirloin burger medium rare, or it could be kind of dry. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. While summer may be the best time for barbecues and rum drinks, in New Orleans, there's a place where you can find tiki-style cuisine and cocktails all year round. Latitude 29 serves up cocktails and modern Polynesian cuisine with a tiki twist. Recently, we spoke with owner Jeff Beachbum Berry and executive chef Chris Shortall about why tiki is all the rage again.
Aloha, my name is Jeff Beachbum Berry, proprietor of Beachbum Berry's Latitude 29 in Bienville House Hotel, French Quarter, New Orleans.
And my name is Chris Shortall. I am the executive chef at Beachbum Berry's Latitude 29 in the great city of New Orleans.
Well, aloha, boys. How nice for you all to come. And if only everybody could see the garb, because I am endlessly just tickled by your Hawaiian shirts that never seem to end, one after another after another. So this is your big topic, tiki drinks, tiki food. Jeff, this is your famous, famous topic because you've been after this for a long time. Tell me about your history with tiki drinks.
Well, it started, we're going to go back a little ways. It started when I was about 6-7 years old. And I wasn't drinking them, but I was taken to Polynesian-themed restaurants as a kid in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. And that was still in the 1960s, part of the golden age of tiki restaurants, where they would spend, in today's money, millions of dollars on the interiors. And they were just beautiful little self-contained movie sets, indoor waterfalls, museum-quality carvings, canoes hanging from the ceiling. You name it, these places had it. They were like little Disney sets with booze. And not only that, but all the drinks came like garnished with ice cones around the straw or flaming or in these magnificent porcelain bowls. And as a kid, I was completely taken with this. I completely fell in love with this faux Polynesia, this Polynesia of the mind. And when I grew up and got old enough to drink, the 1980s, I wanted to go to these places. But they were disappearing. The fad was finally ending, and places were like closing up as fast as I could find them. And at a certain point, I thought, well, if I want to keep drinking these great drinks, I'm going to have to figure out how to make them myself because these places aren't going to be around forever. And that's when I sort of started on this path of researching recipes for tiki drinks and quickly realized that these recipes were never published. They were top secret, very closely guarded industrial secrets. They were very valuable. And consequently, the people who knew them just never wrote them down. But I was fortunate enough to be living and drinking in Los Angeles in the 1980s. And a lot of the guys, and they were always guys, and they were always Filipino guys, who had made these drinks at famous places like Don the Beachcombers or the Luau or the Tiki Tea, places like that, they were still around. And it was just a matter of just sheer dumb luck to stumble on their drinks. You'd look at the bar menu and it would have things like Planner's Punch, Nui Nui, Navy Grog, and it would be sort of a living drink lab. I mean, they would never tell me what was in the drinks. Every time I asked what was in one of these drinks, rum and fruit juice. Okay, that's fine. But what about this other drink? What's in that drink? Rum and fruit juice. So, all right, fine. I'm just going to sit here. I'm going to drink it. I'm going to try to figure out what's in it. I'm going to watch you make it. And that's as far as it got until I put out my first book.
So this was the name of that first book?
The name of the first book was Beach Bum Berry's Grog Log. And that came out in 1994. And all it was me finding recipes, Xeroxing them. I didn't have a Photoshop or a computer or anything like that. I was cutting and pasting with a scissors and scotch tape all the graphics from my collection of cocktail napkins, matchbooks, restaurant menus. I would like Xerox the graphics, cut them out, scotch tape them onto the page, and take them to the Kinko's and re-Xerox them and then white out all the scotch tape marks and put together this little booklet, which I just gave out for free. Because by that time, I was no longer the only person in the world who was interested in this stuff. By the mid-90s, I'd actually met some other people who liked it. When this little free Xerox thing found its way to a comic book publisher in San Jose, who also liked tiki stuff, I said, hey, do you want to turn this into a real book? And I said, yeah, sure, why not? And that became the Grog Log.
So what are you doing in New Orleans, Jeff?
Having the time of my life. this was something that my wife, Anine Kay, alias Mrs. Bum, and I have wanted to do since 2005.
Mrs. Bum. That's
Mrs. Bum.
That's quite a title.
Yeah, especially in Europe where that has a totally different meaning. But we gradually started to realize that, A, writing cocktail books wasn't paying the rent, and B, perhaps we should take all of these recipes I'd been researching for years and maybe serve them ourselves. And C, the only place in the world we wanted to do that was New Orleans. It was just the only place that made sense. That's where the love was. That's where the infrastructure was. That's where people were helpful. And I have to, just take a second here and say that having grown up in Los Angeles and being in the movie business, it's a rather cutthroat city. And it's not enough for you to succeed in Los Angeles. Your best friend has to fail. That's the mentality.
Wow.
But in this city, it was the exact opposite. I mean, everybody here was extremely helpful. I remember the first time I met Neil Bodenheimer of Cure. He sat me down and he started giving me advice about how to run a bar. And being from Los Angeles, I was immediately suspicious. I was like, is this guy giving me bad advice so that I will screw up? Yeah. But after about a minute, I realized this guy is giving me pure gold. This is what I would have to pay a consultant hundreds of dollars an hour for. He was giving me really good advice, and everybody did the exact same thing, and everybody was helpful, and everybody wanted us to succeed. And that's kind of the vibe here, and it just was sort of a no-brainer.
So you open up Latitude 29. What's the name about?
Latitude 29 is the latitude upon which New Orleans sits. More or less, we were called out by Richard Campanella, a geography professor at Tulane. He said it's actually latitude 29.994.
Of course he did.
And then Todd Price of the Times-Picayune tweeted back, what are you, rounding up? Latitude 29 just sounded sexier than Latitude 30.
I get it.
And
I get it.
We're also like right across the street from Engine Company 29, which kind of sealed the deal for
us. Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. So, Jeff, you had the drinks part down. You knew what was going on there. But it's now time to invent a Polynesian menu to go with these Polynesian drinks. And this is, 2014, I guess, is when you all opened. So that's kind of a stretch for 2014. You know, the grog is a little bit easier to swallow, but the grub is unusual.
Right.
So how do you set out to do this, Chris?
Basically, what I knew about Polynesian food was the Polynesian sauce from Chick-fil-A at that point in the game. I got my chops doing fine dining. I started at Restaurant August, and then I opened up Coquette after that with my friend Mike, and then opened my own place. And so I was really learning. I didn't have any traditional culinary training. So I basically was starting with a blank slate, and Jeff and then, I had a good teacher, and Jeff and Anine trusted me to just kind of explore and kind of see where it went. The very first thing I made was the Hawaiian Cuban sandwich. So I took a play at a medianoche, which is a midnight Cuban, usually uses a sweet kind of roll similar to a King's Hawaiian roll, and it's a Cuban sandwich. So I started making my own nice bread very similar to, it's a pineapple bread. So it's based with pineapple juice instead of water. It's got a little bit of this stuff we call tiki powder. And it comes out really nice and tangy and light and a little bit sweet. One of the biggest things that like became a success that was really unexpected was this dumpling burger that we do.
A dumpling burger? What is that?
We, in the process of opening up the restaurant, my sous chef and I, James Rivard, were working, you know, day in and day out. We were developing these dumplings nonstop, just making dumplings every day. And at one point, it was like lunchtime, and we were all there. Just there was construction going on. Everything was getting ready, and we were all hungry. So I just threw a big wad of the hunk of the dumpling meat on the grill and grilled it up like a hamburger, the pork dumpling meat with cabbage and garlic and ginger and all those flavors in it. And I grilled it off, and we had been developing a seaweed bread that we were making. So we were grilling that off, and I cut it in half, and it was still kind of raw in the middle. So I put it on the grill face down and like marked it up real nicely. I took it out to them. They were sitting at a table, and I was like, listen, I know this is not really the direction we're going in. It's kind of a joke, but here, let's try this for lunch. And brought our little dumpling sauce on the side, and they just looked up at me and were like, this is 100% going on the menu. There's no – and we were named 8th best burger in the city for it.
Oh, gosh, that's crazy. That is – so that was the next thing I really wanted to hear about is how you all have been received. You know, what's the reaction from people? What's the reaction from locals? And what's the reaction from tourists?
Well, we wanted to be a local bar. We Anine and I, originally, we were looking in Riverbend. We were looking in Mid-City. We were looking in Bywater. We were looking everywhere but the French Quarter. But that turned out to be, like, the best space for us for a variety of reasons. But we thought, well, now there goes the local trade because nobody's going to want to come into the Quarter and just deal with that hassle and all that. But to our very good fortune, we have become a locals bar. We get a lot of people coming in who live here and coming in again and again and again. And it's been really, really gratifying, especially because it seems to cut across different lines. Like the first type of person who comes in more than once is people my age or older who remember Bali High at the Beach. Uh-huh. Unlike Pontchartrain, which was the big tiki palace out here from the 50s through the 70s. And we've had customers come in and just get all misty-eyed and tear up remembering the place. And we have old Bali High menus that we give them and show them the stuff that we serve that Bali High did. So in addition to that demographic, my demographic, people in their 50s and older, you have younger people coming in. And they're into it for entirely different reasons. I mean, for them, maybe the whole thing is in quotation marks. For them, maybe it's kitsch or camp. Doesn't matter to me. They're still enjoying themselves, and they still are enjoying the food and the drinks, and they're coming back. So no matter what level it hits people at, whether it's a non-ironic, genuinely satisfying thing aesthetically for someone, or it's more of a ironic thing, that's cool either way, as long as we're making people happy.
Jeff and Chris, thank you so much for coming to talk tiki with us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
It's our pleasure.
Jeff Beachbum Berry and Chef Chris Shortall of Latitude 29. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Join us on Thursday, August 27th at the Rouse's Culinary Innovation Center at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum when Times-Picayune food writers Judy Walker and Marcel Bienvenue help host our first Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, Judy and Marcel's Cooking Up a Storm is being reissued in a special hardcover edition. We'll be cooking up a storm with Judy and Marcel and eating up a storm, too. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we visit Stony Point Farms to learn about the peppers and the philanthropy behind the General's hot sauce.
My friends and Tim and the rest of us who are investors sort of had two ideas working. One was starting a company we could all work in together, and most importantly, to write as large a check as we can on a very regular basis to organizations that support troops, veterans, and their families.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com.
Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.